Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. stocks had their worst start to a new year ever this year, 2016. China's economic weakness, today it announced the slowest growth in 25 years at 6.9%, is causing jitters across global markets. Oil's plunge is also bringing new worries to investors. We're looking at what's driving the volatility in the markets and at how the U.S. economy is faring. This hour, On Point, fears and fundamentals behind the wild stock market ride. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do we now live in the shadow of Shanghai? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It was a very rough couple of beginning weeks for this year. End of the week last week, here was Judy Woodruff, PBS NewsHour.
The closing bell on Wall Street signaled the end to a turbulent day and a tough week for markets worldwide. Fueling the sell orders, another plunge on China's Shanghai Composite Stock Index. It's down 18% since the year began.
18% in the first couple of weeks of January, and there's more news. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal and author of Foolproof. Greg Ipp, it's great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Latest news out of China, slowest growth last year in 25 years. Is it the growth rate that has China all tangled up? What's going on?
Well, the growth rate is the slowest in quite a long time, but it's actually not that different from what people expected. It came in at 6.9%, which is just a hair below the 7% that the Chinese government has targeted. I would say that what's shaking up people about China is not necessarily the fact that the growth numbers are terrible, because they really aren't. It's that things have become very unpredictable. You've seen big drops in particular parts of China, in particular heavy investment and construction. Those are the parts of the Chinese economy that are especially intensive users of things that other countries produce, like commodities. The other thing that's going on is the volatility in Chinese financial markets. Traditionally, foreign investors haven't really cared that much what happened on the Shanghai Stock Exchange, because it was a very speculative market. But the big booms and busts we've seen there, plus the volatility in the yuan, have raised big questions about just how much in control the Chinese leadership is of their economy and of their markets. And I think that raises worries over because one of the things they've always taken for granted was that no matter how bad things got, the Chinese government was in control.
The yuan, or renminbi, the Chinese currency, the Asian markets opened up sharply today. At this hour, we don't know how they end. We'll see where Wall Street goes today. There's room for a bounce here as well, I guess. How are people talking about markets globally here? Does it appear that these first 2 weeks have taken the markets through the worst of it, or are people thinking this could still go either way?
Well, forecasting the direction of the market is always a fool's game. But I think one has to distinguish between what looks like a market event versus an economic event. The uncertainty that's emanated of China has been a major risk that people have had to essentially metabolize this year. For the U.S., it's not that the United States sells that much to China, but it sells a lot to other countries like Japan, Canada, Australia, and Brazil that do sell a lot to China. So companies that are exposed to those markets, for example, Caterpillar, are going to take a hit. And of course, the U.S. has become a large oil producer, so the coincident decline in oil prices is also having a big factor. But when you actually look at the economic data for the United States, you do not see signs that this is spreading much beyond those parts of the economy directly exposed to the foreign situation. For example, the service sector continues to grow quite solid. We have very strong employment growth. So from where I sit right now, it looks to me that right now we're having what is perhaps a normal, albeit bit of a stomach-turning, pullback in the markets, as opposed to a foreboding sign that the U.S. is rolling into recession.
People talk a lot about China. They also talk a lot about oil. Now, prices there have been what a few years ago would have looked amazingly low, and that those numbers came down fast. What's the net effect for the U.S. market of these very low oil prices and for the global markets?
Well, you're absolutely right. We're now below $30 a barrel on oil, and it's off a touch again this morning, even as we speak. Now, the traditional conventional wisdom was that because the United States consumes more oil than it produces, a drop in the price of oil ought to be good for the United States. It would be like a tax cut for consumers. That arithmetic has changed a bit in the last 10 years because of the shale revolution. So even though the United States is still a net importer of oil, it's much less of a net importer of oil than it was in the past. And so against those positives for the consumer is a very big negative. Companies that invested and borrowed a lot to drill new wells in the last few years are slashing their investment expenditures. Banks and other investors that lent money to the oil patch are also having to pull back and write off some of those loans. So you're seeing a hit to U.S. growth that you didn't anticipate in the past. And things are probably going to get worse before they get better. With sanctions now lifted from Iran, you have a huge new wave of supply coming from Iranian exports about to hit the markets. So I think, again, as with the commodity bust, it's not so much that this is a sign of really bad news for the United States, but it poses new risks that we're not used to.
What about, you've got big players sitting down in Davos this week in Switzerland for the annual get-together there where all the private jets assemble. And the phrase that's coming out of there looking globally is crisis economy. Looking at China, looking at the Middle East, what we've seen there, the contention between Saudi Arabia and Iran, just all over the place, it seems like there are things bubbling at a vigor that's unsettling people. This crisis economy, do you buy that characterization? Is that hanging over markets?
It's not a crisis economy in the way we thought of the 2008-2009 mortgage meltdown as a crisis, or even the way we thought of the euro sovereign debt problem as a crisis, insofar as the problems you just listed are not posing a huge hit to growth. What I think you see is almost like a huge wave of uncertainty in that the leaders of the world economy seem to be more perplexed and incapable of dealing with the problems that they're facing. So we talked about China and how the Chinese leadership is trying to slow their economy down, reorient their economy towards services and consumption rather than investment. And we have big question marks about whether they're really in control of the process. You have this gigantic wave of refugees that has washed over Europe and a lot of question marks about whether European societies are prepared to absorb these people. Angela Merkel had been until recently the most popular and in-command leader of any country in the Western world. And now she's wrestling with this huge wave of resistance to the large number of refugees she's admitted. Here in the United States, we have two wide open races for president. We have President Obama, whose agenda, for example, improving relations with Iran remains extremely controversial. So I think around the world, what you see is not so much huge negatives for the economy, but big question marks about the ability of our elected, or in some cases not elected, leaders to manage these crosswinds.
And Donald Trump talking tariffs when he looks at China. We've got a lot to take on board here. Greg Ipp with The Wall Street Journal, author of Foolproof. Thank you very much for being with us for a minute, Greg.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Oil way down. Last week, CNN talked about just how far it's fallen.
This is what a crash looks like. An oil market collapse from $108 to $30 in just 18 months.
Sounds like good news, a lot better than going the other way, but the markets between that and China and a whole lot more have really been wobbling. Here's CNBC's Jim Cramer, always with some kind of advice for worried investors. This was Friday.
So the bottom line is keep some powder dry, sell the weak stocks in your portfolio in the next spike up. And remember, in bear markets, we have spikes up. Keep a clear head. And eventually, this too shall pass.
We're going to upgrade our portfolio from Jim Cramer. With me now is Rebecca Patterson, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Bessemer Trust, a wealth and investment firm, oversees more than $100 billion in assets. Rebecca Patterson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
So where is your trouble eye focused here? Is it China, number one? Is it oil? Is it general geopolitical sense of unrest, Europe, refugees, and all the rest? As you look at the investment horizon, what's most on your mind?
Well, of the things you listed, I think the one that keeps me up at night relatively more would be oil, simply because it's hard to see, aside from just valuations, what turns the tide, what stabilizes oil prices, what brings them higher. Saudi Arabia clearly has changed its tactics around oil. It now wants to keep market share rather than defending a certain price. So they're not going to cut production anytime soon. And in the United States, while we have seen the number of oil rigs come down, people are taking them offline, you haven't seen production in the United States come down yet. And as was mentioned earlier, you have new supply coming from Iran. Now, a lot of this is discounted into market valuations already. That's the best news we've got. But what is going to turn it around? At a certain point, do people just think this is too cheap, oil's not going to zero, or is it something else? And it's that uncertainty that probably keeps me up at night. Again, cheap oil is great for the U.S. consumer, great for the global economy on net. But because the U.S. has become such a large producer, there are other negative contagion effects that occur, whether it's to the companies themselves, the high-yield debt markets that helped fund these companies' growth, the banks that made the loans, et cetera.
All that fracking had backers. And what about the China part? You've called China in its awkward teenager phase here. What do you see going on?
Yeah, so China in the short run, if I'm looking at 2016, the one thing that would make me a lot more nervous about the money we manage would be a sudden large devaluation of the currency, something in the magnitude of 8-10% or more. Because if that were to happen, I think we'd get other economies around the world, other central banks weakening their currencies to stay competitive with China. And that massive devaluation would push the U.S. dollar up like a tube of toothpaste. And that would hurt our multinational firms and I think weigh a lot on investor sentiment and U.S. equity markets. So that would worry me. But aside from that, if that does not occur, I think China fears right now actually are overdone. It is an awkward phase for China. They're now the second biggest economy in the world. So it's physically grown. Think of your awkward teenager, right? Mm-hmm. So 6 feet tall, but still developing in other ways. The financial markets aren't very deep yet. You don't have a lot of transparency in China, and you don't have an open capital account. Money can't easily get in and out. And as those things are developing, China doesn't have enough on its plate, so it's trying to transition from a manufacturing to a service economy. So there's all these changes going on at once, and I think that is making investors nervous. Can they manage this transition? Can they grow up to be a functioning adult without wrecking mom's car?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the market's terrible opening of the year. Stock prices down big all over, at least through the end of last week. And why? China's role, oil, the end of easy money, maybe, the crisis economy, some are calling it. This week, you can join us this hour. What do you think? Can the U.S. keep up its pretty decent economic performance with these choppy waters all around? Are you confident in China's economy, near-term, medium-term, long-term? Are you beginning to see that your low gas prices may mean fewer sales for Boeing in Brazil or tough times in North Dakota, maybe in the U.S. banking system? Big players gathering in Davos for the annual economic get-together there. Chinese government television there, CCTV, reporting from Davos today, where world leaders are gathering for the big four-day conference. Here's how they're characterizing the moment.
All this against a somber backdrop of global risks rising, global markets entering bear territory, and also the China slowdown not being properly understood.
Chinese television saying the China slowdown not being properly understood. We'll look at exactly that here from the BBC. Video of laid-off steelworkers, Chinese, who lost their jobs in December. Here's how it looks to them.
He says the shutdown has greatly affected each and every one of us. We've all lost our jobs, he says. We've got old parents and young children we have to provide for. We need that salary.
Their steel plant closed in China. Americans know how that works. Rebecca Patterson is with us, Managing Director, Chief Investment Officer at Bessemer Trust out of New York, oversees more than $100 billion in assets there. With me in the studio right now as well is William Overholt, Senior Fellow at Harvard's Asia Center, former President of Fung Global Institute. It's a Hong Kong-based think tank. Former market strategist for big global investment banks, and author of Renminbi Rising and Asia America and the Transformation of Geopolitics. William Overholt, Bill, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
What's at the heart of the China transition here?
Well, they've got two issues. One is the transition. They've been growing based on exports and investments, and those two engines just aren't working anymore. So they have to grow based on domestic demand, consumption, and services. That transition is very difficult. People think, well, get people to buy more. But retail consumption in China has been growing the last 10 years faster than in any other country. It can't grow any faster. So that's a problem. Changing from a manufacturing base to a services base is also very difficult. In a textile company, the boss tells everybody what to do and they jump and do it. In a restaurant, you have to train your employees but then give them a lot of scope for initiative. And that's a tough social transition in China.
A cultural transition,
yes.
In a way. Mm-hmm.
The second problem is they're doing this when they have a tremendous debt problem. Their local governments are hugely over-indebted. They have a shadow banking system that's a little bit out of control. Their property market has turned down in many cities, leaving banks holding
bags.
Mm-hmm. Their state enterprises are over-indebted. They have enormous overcapacity in industries like steel and aluminum, and they have to work that off. And they thought commodity prices were going to go up forever and demand was going to go up forever. So they have huge excess inventories of raw materials. And working all that off while making a big economic transition is tough.
Are they really going to turn away from manufacturing to services? I mean, I've seen those just, hundred of mile of factories in China from Shenzhen in the south all the way up to that huge radius around Shanghai and way beyond. Is this just a change at the margins, or are they going to see the kind of big swaths of closed down factories that we once saw in the United States not so many decades ago?
Their services economy is already much, much bigger than their manufacturing economy. And they have lost a multiple of the number of manufacturing jobs that we've lost. So the image our politicians have, mm-hmm. that the manufacturing jobs sort of leave Detroit and go to China, is completely wrong. What's going on is huge efficiency gains and a transition to a more service-based economy in both places.
And why can't their old formula keep up, that is, manufacturing and exports plus big investment in that? Why has that reached the end of its useful life?
They went through a labor transition in 2010. They had a huge surplus of labor until then, and now they've got a shortage. And so in the big manufacturing—
Shortage of labor?
Yeah.
Because of an aging population or—
Because of an aging population and because of so much success in growing their economy. Mm-hmm. So wages in the major manufacturing areas have doubled in recent years, and the kind of manufacturing that they've done in the past is all moving to places like Bangladesh and Vietnam. This is a transition our South went through. Mm-hmm. It's a transition Japan went through and Korea, and now it's happening in China too.
Rebecca Patterson in New York, do you see any reason to doubt that though the crunching of gears may be really unsettling right now, that China can pull this off, become a big and more service-oriented economy, and the manufacturing moves elsewhere, and the global economy rolls on?
Well, I don't think we should rule out that they can make it through this transition, maybe with more volatility, but I think it is possible they avoid a crisis along the way. I'm not saying they will definitely avoid it, but I think the market right now is almost assured that there will be a crisis. So I think the pendulum swung too far one way. But we have seen plenty of countries over the years successfully evolve from centrally planned emerging markets to developed economies with strong private firms, et cetera, none have done so on China's scale and with the scrutiny of today's real-time media. I guess one thing I'm hopeful about is that it's in the world's interest to help China through this. Because China is so integrated in the global economy today and is such a big economy in its own right, if China does okay, if they manage through this, we all benefit. You know, if China falls, they're going to bring down global stock markets and hurt the global economy. So every Western policymaker, everyone gathered at Davos today is thinking, how do we help China get through this?
Not everybody's necessarily in that mode. This was Donald Trump in South Carolina, the Republican debate last week, saying he'd be the best candidate to negotiate a trade deal with China. Tariffs.
I'm totally open to a tariff. If they don't treat us fairly, hey, their whole trade thing is tariff. You can't deal in China without tariff. They do it to us, we don't do it. It's not fair trade.
Donald Trump on the stump. You say, help China through this. I'll take that to Bill Overholt. But you also mentioned crisis. Is China in the crisis now, Rebecca? If not, what would it look like when and if it comes?
Sure. You know, China's equity markets have been unusually volatile, really, for the last year. I think China originally thought, if they could slow down the housing market, prevent a bubble in housing, well, how could they help consumer wealth another way? Well, maybe they could encourage people to buy equities and create wealth through equity prices. Mm-hmm. But that didn't work out so well. Everyone bought in thinking China would insure their wealth. And then when China realized they needed to deflate that bubble, it popped spectacularly and the market crashed last summer. And that's created this crisis of confidence around China. The leaders may be able to plan the economy, but can they manage through deepening financial markets? So I think the crisis today, if there is one in China, it's around international confidence that China's leadership can manage through, as Greg Ip and William both said, manage through these multiple transitions at once. I think they can do it. I just think there's a decent-sized risk they can't, and that's what's creating this fear right now, the unknown. Plus, China's just a hard economy to understand, even for folks who've lived in Asia, like myself and Bill.
We'll burrow on into that challenge in China. I want to hear from our listeners as well, if I may. Omaha, Nebraska, Dylan is calling. Hi, Dylan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you.
I had a question. I heard the point brought up that they're transitioning from a manufacturing economy to a services and consumption economy. Well, that kind of makes me question how strong that's going to be when I've been seeing documentaries of ghost malls and all types of ghost construction from China for years now.
What's a ghost mall, Dylan?
Yeah, these ghost malls are malls that are being managed and built with almost no shops in there and no real services or industry around them.
Yeah, we've seen that. We've seen almost ghost cities in China built up with all the investment Bill Overholt's talking about. So what's your question on that?
I'm wondering since the managed economy, it seems like they've had an artificial economy for a long time from my perspective. I'm wondering if that's going to hold true as they transition over to consumption with their ghost industry, it seems like.
Dylan, I appreciate your call. Bill Overholt, speak to that. The ghost quality that's running through some of the Chinese economy, how big a deal is that? Is there an element of artifice that's being exploded now?
You've had an economy that was growing 10%, and investments were based on assumption that was going to continue. So you get ghost malls. You've had an economy where 10 or 12 million people a year were moving from the rural areas into the cities. And China has been more successful than any of the other economies like South Korea and Taiwan at getting ready for that and building up in advance. But it's gotten to the point where it's so complicated that the plans don't always work. And the assumption that 10% growth was going to continue obviously has failed. So they end up with lots of ghost malls and a decent number of ghost cities. Now, they do seem to be managing through this. The property market, on average, has turned around. The property prices are actually growing in most of the major cities again. Some of the smaller cities have terrible problems. A lot of companies are going to go bust or should go bust from having built ghost malls. But this is what's forcing the economy to become a services economy.
Rebecca's sitting there in New York, a big investor herself, representing Bessemer there, and talking about a potential crisis of confidence in the Chinese leadership. It is relatively easy, never easy, but relatively, to manage a big planned economy through decades of super growth. It's a lot trickier when things slow down, get rough, people are displaced, and all the rest. Is a crisis of confidence looming in the leadership itself? Is it justified, Bill?
I think that the leadership is perfectly capable of avoiding some kind of great collapse. The question is whether they can force through these reforms and accept the price that's involved in forcing through the reforms. Let me just take an example and explain what that means. Mm-hmm. We studied one city in southern China, very successful. Their debt service, debts they accumulated in the process of growing very fast, amount to 110% of their tax revenues each year. And they've been paying that off by getting land from the peasants and selling the land. Now, what do the reforms mean? The reforms mean that they're going to be able to take a lot less of the peasants' land. And second,
because there's less demand for that, for new factories,
Central government's going to tell them they can't just
stop, cut it out,
grab the peasants' land so much anymore. And second, they're freeing interest rates, so interest rates are going to go up. So that 110% is going to look bigger. And they're also telling these governments that you have to take care of the rural migrants. Up to now, the rural migrants, who are half of the population of the big manufacturing cities, have not gotten any free education or medical care or pensions. And so you're the mayor of that city, and this looks like a lot, this looks like death to you. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to fight like crazy against the reforms.
These policies.
And similarly, the state enterprise reforms affect the big enterprises. They're over-indebted. They're told that they got to look forward to a level playing field, a lot more competition, a lot tougher scrutiny of their debts, and they're going to push back. So everywhere the leadership looks, the big political interest groups are pushing back against this reform. If they push the reform hard, growth goes down because you're forcing people to deal with these debts. And so the,
but yet they don't have a choice, you say. They have to make the transition?
They have.
Rebecca says there's a risk they won't pull it off.
Yeah. If they want to be successful in the 10-year period, they have to push very hard in the short term, and that means growth is going to go significantly lower than where it is now. Doing that takes a lot of political guts and a lot of political clout. My bet would be that they'll make it through, but it's a bet. It's not a sure thing.
Rebecca, if they stumble in that, or if it takes longer with more turmoil than they hope, how do you factor that into your investment prognosis?
No, it's a great question. You know, we fortunately have been very underweight emerging markets, including China, very underweight commodities in our clients' portfolios for the last few years. So we've suffered less than many in the recent market decline. You know, it's 10 years ago, people didn't even know what the Shanghai Composite was. Mm-hmm. They didn't look at Chinese GDP numbers. Today, China has become such a big economy, you know, contributing nearly 17% to global GDP growth last year, that you have to watch it. The relationship between Chinese and U.S. equities has become stronger and stronger over the last decade. Last year, it reached a record high level. So what happened in China matters for us directly and indirectly. So if I'm going to have a view on U.S. equities, even if I only own U.S. equities, that has to incorporate a view on China.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom. With a quick heads up for you, be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the market's terrible opening of the year. Up today, as we speak, but we'll see where it goes. Stock prices down big all over in the first couple of weeks of 2016. Worst year opening ever. We're looking at why. China's role, oil, maybe the end of easy money, maybe the crisis economy, some are calling it. Rebecca Patterson is with us, Managing Director, Chief Investment Officer at Bessemer Trust, big investment firm out of New York. William Overholt is with us, author of Renminbi Rising, a senior fellow at Harvard's Asia Center, former president of the Fung Global Institute, Hong Kong-based think tank. You can join us as well. Are you confident in China's leaders, its system, to get it right? And how do you see the oil price flowing through the U.S. economy, the global economy, if it stays low? Last week, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest responding Friday to the big slide in U.S. stocks here.
Weakness in other markets with whom we do extensive business is going to be a headwind for the U.S. economy. But we're mindful of that, particularly as the international economy becomes more integrated. We have to be sensitive to movements that we see in the economies of other countries.
And the president talking big, proud about the U.S. economy last week, just last week in his State of the Union address.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
Yeah, take that, Republican presidents. The president would say, but there's a lot of fear talk out there about what's going on with economies. Jamie in Hartville, Ohio. Thanks for calling, Jamie. You're on the air with Rebecca Patterson and Bill Overholt.
Hi, Tom. I was just kind of considering the fact that since America has moved towards this wonderful service economy, and it has managed to wipe out so many people with decent paying jobs and some of the middle class, I can't quite get a grip or understand why another country would want to move towards service space when this is what happened.
Jamie, I appreciate your call. Rebecca, take that on. Donald Trump clearly understands that sentiment. You heard him speaking to it with his comment we played on tariffs right there. Jamie and a lot of others look around and say, boy, it seemed better when we had a lot of manufacturing jobs. Why would China really, really want to do this?
Sure. Well, part of it, I don't think they had a lot of choice. You know, but for the last decade or so, their currency has been strengthening. So the ability of China to have cheap exports, manufactured exports to fuel growth, that's become more difficult. The currency, but also rising wages. So they had to figure out a new way to fuel growth. And I think they're trying to do that in part through focusing more on the service sector and growing the Chinese consumer. But they haven't given up on manufacturing. They're trying to move up the value-added chain, if you will. I think China has aspirations to be the next Germany of very high-quality goods, not just cheap goods, but very high-quality goods. And we've seen countries do that successfully before. I mean, South Korea, I think, is a great example. 10, 15 years ago, you bought a South Korean product because it was cheap. Today, I think a lot of Americans have South Korean washing machines and cars and televisions
fancy
and computers.
Fancy TVs and smartphones.
Absolutely. So if China can grow services, successfully pull off higher value-added manufacturing, and they're also trying to open trade routes to the west of the country, into Asia and parts of Eurasia, if they can do those three things successfully, I think China can manage this transition. And for the U.S., you know, we are going through a big transition ourselves, not just with becoming an oil producer, which has major implications for the economy and for the jobs created here. But then with technology, with globalization, the ability to outsource jobs to other countries, how do we grapple with that? And you see different types of jobs being created for that. But they are being created. Since 2010 alone, we've had more than 3 million jobs created just in professional and business services. So if you're an accountant, a lawyer, engineer, if you design computer systems, you're doing okay. The problem is the economy's just become very bifurcated. If you're in the right sector, you're good to go. If you're not, then you're really struggling still, despite the fact that the economy overall is doing okay.
But that sounds like a potential big problem for China as well. Always a huge sensitivity there to the mandate of heaven and having a populace happy enough to be governed by the Communist Party. Bill Overholt, looking at that Chinese currency, it's already come down. If it should come down a lot more, is that really in Beijing's hands at this point? Or will markets push it if it comes down a lot? Is that a sign that they're I don't know about giving up, but backpedaling on their commitment to reform and saying, no, let's bring the currency down, make our goods cheaper, and export again for some oxygen?
The weaker economy has pulled the currency down, and the leadership has been struggling to keep it up. They want stability. So they spent about a sixth of their reserves, and their reserves are huge.
Trillion plus, way plus.
To hundreds of billions of dollars to keep the currency overvalued compared to the market. It's seriously overvalued compared to the market right now, and has been for about a year. The problem is the market is very powerful. So when it bumps down a little bit, it's not because they're doing some kind of predatory mm-hmm. undervaluing. Mm-hmm. It's because the market is winning, and reform means going with the market. So the more they reform, the more the renminbi is going to come down,
which pulls them away from the reform they want to make. Does it not pull them away from the reform that they desire to make? Because then it may draw manufacturing and exports up again.
It does. This is the great struggle, and it's just a microcosm mm-hmm. of what's happening across the board, making reform very difficult for them.
Scott in Madison, Wisconsin. Scott, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a three-part question. Mm-hmm. Half of China's exports to the United States are from U.S. Manufacturers based in China. How will that affect the United States? Second, China is withdrawing money from our treasuries and their investments in the U.S. in general to get money back home. Mm-hmm. How will this affect the United States and the U.S. dollar's position as a reserve currency to the world? Finally, how has the lack of consumer demand in the West affected China, and what part has that played in this crisis?
Let us take those backwards. Rebecca, let me come to Western consumer demand first, and you. Is China suffering because Western economies have suffered in the aftermath of the Great Recession?
Sure. That is part of it. You know, if you listen to speeches recently from Chinese leaders, they definitely highlight that weaker demand from their major trading partners has been one factor weighing on their growth. So I don't think that's insignificant. Maybe the good news here is that Europe has some cyclical economic momentum. Their economy, it's all mm-hmm. relative. Europe grows more slowly than America generally, but they're growing and they're getting through some of their recent crises. And so that's certainly at the margin helpful for China. And the U.S., again, it's a bifurcated economy right now, but overall we are still growing, and so that is helpful for China. So it does matter what happens in the West for China. It goes both ways. And if I can just tackle that second one quickly mm-hmm. on, you know, China trying to manage its currency has meant that they've started selling U.S. treasuries. And is that something we need to worry about? And China's not alone. You're seeing a lot of large central banks from Saudi Arabia to China to Russia to Norway selling U.S. treasuries to use those funds to help manage their currencies. But the good news for America is that U.S. Treasury yields are high compared to a lot of other places in the world. In most of Europe, interest rates are negative. So the U.S. Treasury yield looks mighty attractive to them, even if it's only 2%. So we're seeing a lot of private investor money coming to buy U.S. Treasuries. That's offsetting the selling of treasuries from China and other places and holding our yields remarkably stable. So as long as Europe stays with easier monetary policy than the United States, I don't think the China selling of treasuries poses a risk. And I don't think the dollar as a reserve currency is at risk, at least during my career, maybe even during my lifetime. For China or the euro or another currency to take over, I think will take a long time to build that critical mass of volumes.
Bill Overholt, we've heard a lot about wealthy Chinese voting with their feet in a way, moving cash or trying to out of China. What's the significance of that? Is that a vote of no confidence in China's reform and its transition?
It's a vote of fear about the Chinese legal system and about the anti-corruption campaign. China's the best place in the world to make money. It's the hardest place in the world to keep it. The people who've been richest person in China have very frequently ended up in jail. Almost always there was some important political connection that helped make those billions, or there were some corrupt payments along the way, so it gets taken away mm-hmm. as fast as. So the idea is make a lot of money and get it out, buy California real estate,
mm-hmm.
buy condos in New York, but $900 billion left China last year.
Wow,
$900 billion.
That's a lot.
This is a huge development, and it also makes reform difficult because reform includes completely opening your capital markets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they completely open their capital markets, everybody in China is going to try
off
to get their money out.
Watch out. Rebecca, what about the issue of American companies manufacturing in China? Does all of this affect that in an important way? Does it stay there? Does it move on to Bangladesh or you name it?
I think a lot of U.S. companies still see China through the longer-term lens. If you're looking out the next 5 or 10 years, yes, the economy is growing more slowly, but it's a bigger economy that's growing more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a decade or so ago, this was an economy that was $2 trillion. Today, it's almost $11 trillion. So it's a bigger pie growing more slowly, but the total opportunity set is still there. So I think you'll continue to see a lot of U.S. interest in doing business in China. I think what kind of business you're doing might change. If this is an economy that's less about cheap labor, cheap wages, cheap manufacturing, and more about would-be German manufacturing and services, you could see a rotation of the sort of businesses that are taking advantage of that China opportunity. But I don't think it goes away. It's too big. It's too important and too large a source of potential revenue.
What about on the oil front? It's gone so low, and you say that is as big or bigger a concern for you when you look at global markets and the U.S. market looking forward. How do you compare the China threat, the oil threat? How do they look to you, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons the markets had such a horrific start to the year, which you keep painfully reminding me whenever we get off commercial break, that's okay. But it's just too many uncertainties. You had oil, you had Saudi Arabia, you had a North Korea possible nuclear test, mm-hmm. you have China, and on and on and on. And when there's too many question marks, investors say, let's just take some money off the table and figure it out, and then maybe we'll get back in. So I think that's a big part of it. In the case of oil, you know, God bless American ingenuity. I think that's a big part of it. Technology and creative thinking and a good business environment has allowed companies to get oil out of the ground so much more effectively. The problem is they didn't plan on $20 or $29 a barrel oil. And so some of these companies aren't going to be profitable, and we will see bankruptcies in the coming months and quarters. But there's a saying in oil, low prices solve oil prices. When prices get low enough, supply will come off. It'll be painful, but mm-hmm. supply will come off. and then we'll recover. And the U.S. as a producer, I think, is here to stay.
Bill, what about when Donald Trump talks about tariffs on China these days, on Chinese manufactured goods coming into this country? Do you see that as just political stump speech here? And what about political friction between the U.S. and China as each wrestles, now both such huge economies, with its economic with their economic challenges?
Well, the proposal to put huge tariffs on China would be catastrophic for us.
Because China would retaliate?
There would be a trade war. But in fact, Chinese tariffs on manufactured goods are very low, just as ours are. But in order to understand why it would be catastrophic, it's important to blow up a myth about our trade and our trade deficit with China. Mm-hmm. If you look at a Nike shoe, it gets exported from China to here, maybe it costs $120. So to a politician, that means China got $120 and we got nothing. Mm. In reality, China just sewed that shoe together, and almost all the rest of the $120 comes to America. We did a study of what happens with a suit exported from China for $425. And again, that looks on a politician's accounts like $425 mm-hmm. for Off China, nothing mm-hmm. for us. It turns out that we get 84% of the value of that suit. The Chinese mostly sewed it together. And so what would happen would be when we cut off that trade, as Donald Trump wants to do, we would lose that 84% of the $425 on millions and millions and millions of goods. Be absolutely catastrophic for American consumer and for American companies.
Listeners, bear that in mind as we head deeper into this political season. Also, some sympathy for the Chinese leaders on the other side trying to deal with their own big transition here, their own politics. For that matter, with oil politics and economics globally now playing out. William Overholt with the Asia Center at Harvard University, author of Renminbi Rising. Thank you so much for coming in today, Bill. Good talking with you. Rebecca Patterson at Bessemer Trust, Chief Investment Officer there and Managing Director. Rebecca in New York, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, good luck to you. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can be first to get tomorrow's topics and look at our guests coming up by heading over to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's face it. When have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, the popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel southern ladies, our family became an old west town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.